Okay. So our topic for tonight is the War of Independence from May 15th through the end of the first round of fighting, which came to a halt on June 11th. So 4 weeks of fighting, followed by a four-week truce, a ceasefire, that was negotiated by the United Nations and put into effect and lasted until or through July 8th. So we're dealing with 4 weeks of fighting and 4 weeks of relative quiet. Now, last time we discussed the battle for Jerusalem and the fate of the old city and the Jewish quarter and how the Jewish quarter fell to the Jordanian legion. But as the battle for Jerusalem was unfolding, both Israelis and Jordanians came to realize the importance of the road to Jerusalem, especially the section that passed Latrun to the Shar Hagai, the Bab al-Wad, where the road goes from the coastal area, then through a narrow valley and up the hill, the Judean hills into Jerusalem. But John Pasha Glob, the leader of the Arab Legion, came to this realization even before the Jews did. And he made some quick decisions that proved very helpful to the Jordanian cause. The Arab Liberation Army, the ALA, had occupied the Taggart Fort at Latrun ever since the British left in the middle of April. But Glob ordered the ALA to evacuate entirely from the West Bank because he didn't want any competition on the Arab side. He wanted the Jordanian Arab Legion to have complete control of the West Bank. And so they took over the fort on May 14th. In truth, the road to Jerusalem remained open despite the Legion occupying the fort at Latrun for the next few days, up through the 17th of May. But then, on the 18th of May, the Legion deployed its forces between Latrun and Bab al-Wad and effectively shut the door to Jerusalem. It was closed. Now you couldn't get in convoys in and out from the coastal plain, the Jewish areas, to western Jerusalem. This is a disaster because Jerusalem has 100,000 Jews living there, and they need to be resupplied constantly. Jerusalem, being a city, an urban environment, needs an influx of food and medicine and supplies on a regular basis. It can't serve itself as outlying rural communities can. So something needed to be done to open up the road to Jerusalem. David Ben-Gurion ordered an assault on Latrun because he was neurotic about the fate of the holy city. He was concerned that you can't have Zionism without Zion and what's going to happen to the 100,000 Jews there. It was of critical importance to him, not just that the Jewish state survive and thrive, but that Jerusalem be a part of the Jewish state. So he ordered three successive assaults on Latrun, each one of which will fail with terrible loss of life. So if you thought that the War of Independence was one big victory party for the Jews, it's not. There are some real setbacks, and Latrun was maybe the worst of them. Actually, not necessarily the worst, but among the worst. Okay. It would turn out in the end that these battles for Latrun were unnecessary because an alternative road to Jerusalem was found and eventually not paved, but through an engineering feat made passable in the days before the ceasefire. But at least on May 24th, that isn't yet known. So on May 24th, the first battle takes place. Yigal Yadin, who is the head of operations for the Haganah, the IDF doesn't yet exist. The IDF will be created a week later. Yigal Yadin knew that Israeli forces were ill-prepared and were insufficiently armed, and they were unready. And he begged for a postponement. He begged for a postponement. But Ben-Gurion, acting as a generalissimo, a man with all power who will make all decisions, he said, no, I order you, make the attack on Latrun. So it's going to have to happen. If the boss man wants it, it's going to happen. So it's going to happen right away. Operation Bin Nun, named after Yehoshua Bin Nun, was to take place at night. It was supposed to be a nighttime operation, but for whatever reason, it was delayed by 6 hours. And that made all the difference. It forced the operation to take place in daylight, and it guaranteed that its failure. The attack never really happened. Israelis were spotted by the Jordanians as they approached, and so the Jordanians unleashed a heavy barrage of artillery fire. Israelis had to retreat in a disorderly fashion, and soldiers were hiding behind rocks, desperate for cover. So they really had no air support, nothing. They were just desperately trying to get away, using whatever rocks in the field to save them from the Jordanian fire. Moreover, it was very hot. It was 95 degrees and high humidity, and the Khamsin was blowing. So the physical conditions were very taxing on these soldiers, some of whom weren't really soldiers. They were just new immigrants who were handed a rifle, and they didn't even know how to fire the rifle. Some of them didn't speak Hebrew. Because it was hot, they were begging not for mayim, but for vasser. They wanted water. They said it in Yiddish because they didn't even speak Hebrew. Some of them were Holocaust survivors just off the boat. The lasting image of the Battle of Latrun, is that of Ariel Sharon. Sharon, who was 20 years old at the time, was hit in the head at the first Battle of Latrun. And later you'll see there's an image of him wrapped with a head bandage that would serve him well later in his career. It means that he was an injured war hero. And he was crying, "Mommy, Mommy, Ima," in the field. The death toll was terrible. 72 Jews died, 5 Arabs. And there was a psychological blow that was very terrible as well, because this meant that just because the Haganah wants to take a position, it doesn't mean that it's going to be able to occupy it. That the Haganah is capable of being defeated, and defeated soundly. So the Jordanians could have forced the issue, having won the Battle of Latrun, the first battle. They could have pushed down the hill and pressed towards Kibbutz Hulda, which was the staging ground for all the convoys to Jerusalem. But they didn't. Why did they not push to Kibbutz Hulda? Well, remember last week we were discussing how the Jordanian legion was pushing its forces from Ramallah down towards Jerusalem through Sheikh Jarrah to the Damascus Gate, and that they were successful, but that for whatever reason they didn't bother pushing southwestward towards the municipal center of Jewish Jerusalem? Well, we have an answer. And the answer is that this was not a war to the finish. This was not total war. And the Jordanians were not really interested in destroying the Jewish state. They may have been interested in truncating it, but not by all that much. The Arab Legion had basically conceded that whatever was allotted to the Jewish state by the partition plan was going to remain in Jewish hands. And Latrun, which was allotted to the Arab state, was going to remain in Arab hands. So although there were these key moments where the Jordanians could have pushed further and really done serious damage to the cause of Jewish statehood, they held back. Okay. Now, Dov Yosef, or Bernard Joseph, who was the military governor of Jerusalem, warned Ben-Gurion that we have a problem. What's the problem? That Jerusalem only has several more days of food left, and we have to feed 100,000 people. So you're going to have to find a new way to supply the city. The first attack on Latrun failed. Well, the Jordanians fully expect that there's going to be a second attack on Latrun to open up the road to Jerusalem. So the Jordanians ask the Egyptians and the Iraqis for help. What do the Egyptians and the Iraqis have to do with anything? Well, first of all, they can strafe from the air Israeli positions in the vicinity. And also, they can have ground assaults. So the Iraqis attacked Geulim, which is near Netanya, in order to siphon troops away from the Latrun area that the Jews should have to defend the waste of the country. And the Egyptians advanced their army from Ashkelon, or Majdal, to Izdud, or Ashdod, that they went further up the coastal road. They had really stopped at Ashkelon, but they went a little further. Some say it's because they wanted to occupy all the territory allotted to the Arabs in the Gaza district, and some say it was to help out the Jordanians to siphon Jewish troops away from the Latrun battle site. Whatever the reason is, Ben-Gurion is getting nervous. He knows that he has to try again because the United Nations are interested in imposing a ceasefire in the very near term. On May 29th, the United Nations General Assembly called for a 4-week ceasefire. So the Jews are running out of time. And if Jerusalem were still cut off when the ceasefire went into effect, then you could kiss West Jerusalem goodbye from the Jewish state. It'll either be occupied by the Arabs or will go international. But either way, it's not what Zionism wanted. Okay. So the second battle for Latrun Operation Bin Nun Bet, so Yoshua Bin Nun, the second time over, takes place at midnight of May 30th going to May 31st. But Israel in this battle made a big mistake. They made a mistake of not sending the vast bulk of their forces to attack the main target of the fort, but rather their forces were spread out. They were diffused around the broader battle zone, and that cost them. There was partial success in taking most of the village of Latrun, but not in taking the military fort. At daybreak, when the light is the sun is out there and everyone is visible again, Israel withdrew its troops, having suffered 44 dead. So 72 dead in the first battle of Latrun, failure. 44 dead in the second battle of Latrun, and effectively failure. The third battle of Latrun, known as Operation Yoram, took place on the night of June 8th and 9th, and it was riddled with blunders, major mistakes. People went the wrong direction, they went to the wrong hill, they got their maps incorrect, and it failed, and Israel suffered 16 dead. But it turned out that Yoram was totally superfluous. Israel didn't need to go to war, to go to battle against the Jordanians at Latrun or Shar Hagai on that night, because the Burma Road was already functioning. So what is the Burma Road? I'm sure most of you have heard of the Burma Road. The original Burma Road was in Burma. It was a way of avoiding Japanese control over the roads in the Far East for the British and the Americans to resupply. And so whenever you have a road that goes through an out-of-the-way place to circumvent the enemy, it could be called the Burma Road. Well, what happened here was that on May 28th, Palmach scouts had made their way from Huldah all the way to Jerusalem undetected by the Arabs. And with the conquest of certain Arab villages along the route, which went to the south of the main highway, it became clear that Israel was able to resupply Jerusalem by this circuitous method. The trouble was that there was no real road. It was just a path through forest and other terrain that was as yet impassable for trucks and for convoys. So it would take a massive effort by engineers and heavy equipment to make a serviceable road out of this passageway to the south of the main highway. Now, the Arab Legion was aware of what was going on. They knew that the Jews needed to make a pathway to Jerusalem and that they wanted to do it in a way that didn't come under artillery fire. And the Jordanians could hear the sounds of heavy equipment moving earth and rocks, but there was nothing the Jordanians could do other than try to fire artillery shells that were going blindly and passed right overhead and didn't do any damage. So in the end, on June 10th, one day before the ceasefire took effect, the Burma Road was able to supply civilian convoys to Western Jerusalem. Okay. Also very important, the water pipeline that went from the coastal plain to Jerusalem was stopped, was blocked at Latrun by the Jordanians. With the creation of the Burma Road, a new water pipeline was laid that was in a safe area that could not be blocked. Can you explain the so Moshe is asking to explain the role of Mickey Marcus in the war. So Marcus was invited to serve on the general staff. Yeah, he had been a graduate of West Point and played in some sort of a heroic role in World War II for the Americans, and was invited by Ben-Gurion because Ben-Gurion wanted a professional soldier's assessment of the fighting capabilities of the Haganah and to try to improve the fighting capabilities of the IDF in its early phases. And his advice and counsel was very much appreciated by Ben-Gurion. Sadly, Marcus died from friendly fire. Had he spoken Hebrew, it's possible that this would not have happened, that a sentry was at night who didn't see who it was and didn't recognize him, and miscommunication because of language barrier, and shot Marcus, and Marcus died, sadly, and then was buried at West Point. I think the only person who died in the service of a foreign country buried at West Point. So he was one of many Americans and Anglo-speaking Jews who volunteered their services in the War of Independence, but his role was not that of a fighter directly, but rather as offering guidance at the general staff level. Okay. So after a month of fighting between the Arab Legion and Israel, what had actually taken place? So a partition had taken place, a partition between the West Bank, or what will eventually become the West Bank, and Israel proper. Instead of a newly created Palestinian Arab state existing side by side with a newly created Jewish state, instead you have the Jordanians occupying the West Bank. The Legion suffered heavy casualties, between 400 and 500 dead. That might not sound like a lot, but there only were 8,000 soldiers in the Legion to begin with. And so that's a pretty large percentage of their total forces. And they could not afford many more casualties. For this reason, and moreover, they exhausted their supply of ammunition and artillery, and resupply was far from certain. The British were not able to do so because of an embargo. And so the Arab Legion was in not good straits, really, at the end of the 4 weeks of fighting that ended on June 11th. The IDF, by contrast, would grow by leaps and bounds during the ceasefire because their manpower would be increased and they'd get Czech weaponry. So the Jordanians did very well for themselves early in the war, but they would have been very happy, very pleased for the war to just completely come to an end. As far as they were concerned, they would happy to have a permanent ceasefire, keep their gains, vizehu, and no more. As we'll see soon enough, they don't have that luxury because the Arab world is not ready to stop fighting, and the Jordanians can't be seen as losers or weaklings or quislings or traitors and not going along with the Arab cause. So against their better judgment, Abdullah and Pasha Glob are going to end up participating in further battles later in the war. Okay, next point. Let's go to the Egyptian front. King Farouk refused the Grand Mufti's request for the Mufti to accompany invading Egyptian forces into Palestine. Why did he refuse the Mufti's request? Because everyone hates the Mufti. The Mufti's a bad guy. All right? Everybody thinks he's a jerk, and even the Arabs don't like him, and they don't want him having any power whatsoever over what had been British Mandate Palestine. So the Egyptian army also failed to prepare for war. This was one big joke. The Egyptians did not take seriously the prospect for real conflict, real fighting. They had been equipped and trained by the British ever since 1936 on the Anglo-Egyptian Treaty. However, during World War II, Egypt's loyalty to the Allied cause was very suspect. I mean, generally, the Arabs preferred the Axis. They loved Hitler. Why? Hitler hated the Jews, a variety of reasons. But the point is, the British did not trust the Egyptians, and so therefore they did not grow and expand and modernize the Egyptian army. Which meant that in 1948, the Egyptian army was not all that formidable when it goes to war against Israel. What did Egypt do? Egypt pushed northward, up the coast, through the Gaza Strip. A smaller contingent went in a northeasterly direction towards Hebron, Beit Lechem, and the southern reaches of Jerusalem. And we mentioned last week that in the Battle of Ramat Rachel, there were Egyptian forces. Egypt failed to supply proper rations to its soldiers, and did not maintain appropriate field kitchens. This might sound like a silly little thing or a petty thing, but no, it's a big deal. If your troops are hungry, they can't fight, and they didn't have sufficient food. And this will cost them in the long run. The Egyptians bombed Tel Aviv from the air for the first 6 days of Israel's existence, from May 15th to May 20th. They caused casualties, especially at the central bus depot, where 40 people were killed, and Jewish morale fell. However, in the process, Egypt lost most of their planes, and the bombing proved not to be a decisive factor in the war. What was Israel's major first line of defense? So this is an important component in the history of the war, namely the northern Negev settlements. Israel's settlements in the northwestern Negev and along the coastal plain just north of Gaza will prove to be of utmost importance in stymieing the Egyptian advance. So they fought bravely and caused the Egyptians to bleed heavily. Yitzhak Sadeh, a former leader of the Haganah and now an advisor, military advisor to Ben-Gurion, wanted to evacuate some of these settlements because he thought they could not be saved. And in fact, some of them were not saved in the long run. Kfar Daron was not saved. Nitzanim was not saved. But Ben-Gurion refused because he felt that the heroic Yishuvim were buying time for Israel to absorb newly arrived weaponry and to bolster its armed forces. In other words, Israel is weak on May 15th. Israel is weak on May 17th, 19th, 20th. But Israel is going to be a lot stronger on May 30th, or for that matter, on June 10th. So as time goes on, Israel is getting stronger. It has more people under uniform and more weapons at its disposal. So if these yishuvim, these little settlements, can block the Egyptian advance, even just for a few hours or days, that makes a big difference. And it did. Okay. The Egyptian attackers were incompetent, and their own mortar fire caused self-inflicted injuries and casualties. They were lazy. They used to eat lunch 600 yards away from the enemy in open sight. So Yad Mordechai was the key battle. Yad Mordechai was named after Mordechai Analevitz, the hero of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, and it was founded by mostly Holocaust survivors. So Yad Mordechai fought off the Egyptians from May 19th to May 23rd. But eventually they were evacuated. They had nothing left in the tank. They had to be evacuated lest every last person die. Ben-Gurion criticized the evacuation because, as I've mentioned in the past, Ben-Gurion didn't want any evacuations. He wanted every position to be held to the last man. Well, it's easy to say that when you're sitting in the Kirya in Tel Aviv. It's quite another thing when you're on the ground, dying a hero's death. So Yad Mordechai was, although formally speaking, an Egyptian victory, was really a Jewish victory because the Egyptians sustained so many losses and their momentum was stopped for a good 5 days. On May 24th, a day later, the Egyptians took Ashkelon and stopped. On May 28th, they took Ashdod and stopped. They didn't go any further. Why did they not go any further than Ashdod? Why did they not threaten Tel Aviv or Jaffa or Rehovot? Why not just keep going up the coast until you get to the heartland of Zionism, Tel Aviv? So there are a variety of explanations for this. But the most important one is we should recognize the Egyptians can't just advance because there's limited opposition in front of them. They have to be able to sustain whatever it is they already took. And if their supply lines are thin and they have a limited amount of troops and materiel, they're reluctant to expose themselves to danger. Okay. So Operation Peleshet was an attack on the Egyptians at Ashdod. In Zionist historiography, this battle stopped the Egyptian march toward Tel Aviv. But in truth, the Egyptians had already stopped themselves prior to the battle, and actually the Egyptians won the battle of Ashdod at Operation Peleshet. But the psychological effect of the battle was a victory for Israel because it sowed panic among the Egyptian soldiers. They got nervous. The Egyptians feared that they were overextended, and they were inclined to pull back. What was good for the Egyptians was that they established the link through the Fallujah pocket between the eastern and western arms of the invasion. So if you think about a map, there's this invasion and this invasion, okay, and there's a connection between the two. So make like an H, a vertical line, and a horizontal line, an H. For the next few months, what the Egyptians will want to do is to expand that east-west chain and besiege a southern enclave of Israeli settlements. What Israel will try to do is to break that linkage, the east-west linkage, and end the siege of the beleaguered northern Negev Jewish settlements. Okay. But because the Egyptians have to protect their lines of communication, it means it's cost them the initiative. They really can't go any further. They're not going to attack any further. The Iraqi army. What is the Iraqi army trying to do here? Flori, I'm in the middle of a class. So the Iraqi army was the Jordanians' junior partner, and it had its own agenda. They wanted the Haifa oil refinery because the oil pipeline went from Baghdad all the way to Haifa, and they want to take the oil refinery. Israel lost a battle against the Iraqis, the Battle of Jenin, on June 1st through 3rd, but the Iraqis But they gave the Iraqis enough of a fight to teach the Iraqis not to try to attack again. And so there never was a thrust across Israel's narrow waist. You always think about Israel being a narrow country, east-west, you know, near the West Bank. How many miles is it? 11 miles, 12 miles, 13 miles. Israel is a very narrow country. Well, there never was a serious attempt in the 1948 war to split Israel into two along an east-west attack, to make it a north-south country by east-west attack. It never happened. It was feared that this would happen, but it didn't come to pass. The Iraqis didn't do it. The Jordanians didn't do it. What about the Syrians? So the Syrians had very low work ethic among their soldiers. They were lazy. They took naps. It's unclear what they really wanted to accomplish. What were the Syrian war aims? So some say they were very maximalist. They wanted to destroy Israel or take the bulk of the Galilee. However, others say they just wanted a symbolic victory, whether at Tiberias or along the shoreline of the Yama Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee. The Syrians invaded at the southern end of the lake, and they took Samach, and they attacked Degania. But at one of the most famous battles of the War of Independence, the Deganias held. So the mother of all kibbutzim, Degania, and this is depicted in the movie Exodus, held off, and Degania was spared. So because the Syrians didn't break through at the southern part of the lake, they decided to break through at the northern part of the lake. So south of Lake Chula, which doesn't exist anymore, and north of the Kinneret, they attacked again at Mishmar HaYarden, and they were able to take the village and hold territory. So prior to the first ceasefire, the Syrians held territory in what was supposed to be Israel. This was the only example where territory allotted to the Jewish state in the partition plan was not in Jewish hands, that the Syrians took a little sliver of what was supposed to be Israel on the west side of the Jordan River. Okay, that will prove significant in peace negotiations in 1949 and still even be relevant up until the Six-Day War in 1967. Okay, well, the Lebanese, what did the Lebanese do? At the last minute, the Lebanese decided, we're not going to go to war with Israel. We're not going to invade. Why did they make that decision? So, several reasons. Number one, the Maronite Christians had a favorable attitude towards Zionism. Secondly, the Shiite villages just north of the border had generally good relations with the Yishuvim, the Jewish settlements south of the border. And most importantly, the Lebanese politicians feared that their military was weak and that in a conflict with Israel, what would happen? Israel would occupy southern Lebanon. Sounds like 1978 and 1982. Israel and South Lebanon are like come together. So the Lebanese, they're afraid. The Jews are strong. They could defeat us. Let's not pick a fight with them. However, to cover themselves in the world of Arab politics, they don't want to be seen as weaklings and quislings and the like. What do they have to do? They have to offer some logistical support and send a token force together with the Syrians over the border. So the Lebanese briefly held Al-Malakia, which today is Kibbutz Malkia, just over the Israeli side of the line. Al-Malakia changed hands about five times over the course of a few days, but as I said, eventually became part of Israel and a kibbutz. Okay, so everyone tried to create facts on the ground in the hours before the truce went into effect. Grab something before it's too late. You know, if you see an unoccupied position and it's near your front line, take it because you won't be opposed and it'll be yours forever. Everybody's trying to do facts on the ground the last few days before the ceasefire. Air and naval battles were hardly relevant during the 4 weeks of war. Ben-Gurion did order, however, the bombing of Arab capitals in the first week of June. Why did he do this? So some say, well, first of all, by the way, Ben-Gurion was in London during the Blitz. And so he experienced what it was like for an enemy to bomb a capital city full of civilians and government administration. So he knew about that. But why did he call for the bombing of Arab capitals? So some say it was a fit of anger over how badly the battles of Latrun were going. You know, Ben-Gurion wanted Latrun, he wanted Jerusalem, he's all on a tither, the world is coming to an end. So he lashed out and said, we'll bomb the Arab capitals. That's one explanation. Another is that It was revenge for the bombing of Tel Aviv in the first few days of the war by the Egyptians. But in a fit of prophetic inspiration, because Ben Gurion was a Navi sometimes. You know, he was an atheist or a pantheist, but he was like a Navi. He would say, "We have to bomb the Arab capitals to avenge our ancestors' ignominy, to avenge against Mitzrayim for enslaving the Jewish people, and to avenge against Ashur, Assyria, Iraq, for what they did to our people, and Aram, Syria, for what they did to our people." So he's quoting right out of scriptures that we got to give the comeuppance to our enemies from biblical times. All right, that's Ben Gurion for you. Okay, so Amman was hit, and the British didn't like it because the British and the Jordanians are hand in glove. So the British Foreign Office threatens Israel, if you don't stop hitting the Jordanians in Amman, we're going to blow up Tel Aviv. So, all right, fine, no more Amman. Then they attack Damascus and puts the fear of God or the fear of Allah into the Syrians. Okay. A summary about what happened in the first 4 weeks of war. These 4 weeks were the only chance that the Arabs had of actually winning the war. It was then and only then that they had the initiative, that they had numerical superiority and qualitative advantage in terms of firepower. And yet the Arabs lost. The Syrians took only a symbolic piece of eastern Galilee. The Iraqis and the Jordanians took the territory of the West Bank, plus the old quarter of the Jewish quarter of the old city. The Egyptians took the Arab territory of the Gaza area, plus cut off the northern settlements of the Negev. But Israel held firm against a four-pronged Arab assault, took territory beyond what was allotted to it in the partition plan, was on the offensive in all sectors, and had a larger army at the end of the 4 weeks than it did at the beginning of the 4 weeks. The bottom line was that everyone needed a respite. Everyone needed a pause in the fighting because they were tired. And in the view of some Israeli generals, it was like the dew came down from the heavens. It's Tal mi shamayim for Israel's weary formations. Now let's talk about the truce. How did it come about? Who put it into effect? And why it failed? Okay, so the truce lasted from June 11th through July 8th, with fighting beginning again on July 9th. The UN General Assembly appointed a mediator for Palestine on May 14th. This mediator was Count Folke Bernadotte. Who was Folke Bernadotte? So he had been the deputy head of the Swedish Red Cross during World War II, and he was credited with saving thousands of lives of citizens of Western and neutral countries who had gotten caught up in Germany through his White Buses program of early 1945. That these buses were all white except for a red cross, the symbol of the Red Cross, and they were able to escape German-controlled territory and bring to safety Danish citizens, Norwegian citizens, some Swedish citizens, even some British. There was a Lashon Hara about Folke Bernadotte that he refused to help Jews. And for years, Bernadotte's heirs had to defend against the charges that he was an anti-Semite and that he didn't help Jews. The record seems to indicate that he did help Jews, that several hundred of them were part of the many thousands of people who were saved through his efforts. Okay, but he didn't know very much about Palestine or the Middle East. When he was appointed, basically he was an Amar Eretz Gamur. So how is he supposed to effect a truce, a ceasefire, if he's an Amar Eretz Gamur? He doesn't know what he's talking about. Well, the answer is he has a deputy. And his deputy is the world's expert. And who's that? Ralph Bunche, Dr. Ralph Bunche, who was a black American, who was a member of the UN Secretariat, a professional diplomat, not working for the U.S. State Department, but rather working for the UN. And he had served on UNSCOP as the deputy head of UNSCOP. So he knew the country and the situation, and the division of the country. He was the brains behind the mediation of the ceasefire and beyond. Okay, so the UN called for a truce on May 22nd to begin on May 24th. They always give 48 hours for you to mop up your military activities. Israel accepted and the Arabs rejected. The British very much wanted a truce. Why? Because they fear that the Arabs will lose. And if the Arabs start losing, the Arabs will blame the British for their losses and say that the British were really secretly allied with the Jews. And then British relations with the oil-producing states of the Middle East will be compromised. So the British want the Arabs to win, or at least not to lose badly, because they're afraid if the Arabs lose badly, it's bad for British oil interests. Okay.
The Americans and British together also preferred a ceasefire because they believed that continued warfare would be a pretext for the Soviet Union to intervene militarily in the Middle East. And the Americans and the British fear the extension of Soviet tentacles to another part of the world. So better to have peace, keep the Ruskies out. Okay. Well, the Security Council voted for a truce and an arms embargo on May 29th to take effect on June 1st and to last for 4 weeks. But the two sides have to agree. It has to be mutual. It's not enough for the UN just to say we're going to impose it. If the two warring factions don't agree to it, then it doesn't matter. So it was the responsibility of Bernadotte to try to get the two sides to agree to the truce. The Arabs opposed. Why did the Arabs oppose a truce in early June? The answer is, well, three answers. First of all, they believed, and they were correct in believing it, that a truce of a temporary nature would be more in the interest of the Jews than of the Arabs. The Jews will get the better of it than the Arabs will, therefore the Arabs decide to oppose it. Secondly, and this is a very important one, the Arab leaders feared that the Arab street wanted war. And if they didn't continue the war, but rather they capitulated towards a UN ceasefire, the regimes would be seen as traitors, and they'd be overthrown violently with people getting their heads chopped off. So, and the third point, which is really a building up on the second point, the Arab public would not understand the reason for the truce because ever since May 15th, they had been fed propaganda about Arab victories and will be marching on Tel Aviv in 2 weeks. So if your civilian population, which is a riled up and rowdy bunch to begin with, thinks that they're winning, and all of a sudden you pull back and say, well, we didn't win. In fact, we had to agree to a peace terms, then that really looks bad for you. It's like by the Germans in World War I, where they didn't understand why it is that their government agreed to a ceasefire, to an armistice, when they thought they were winning, when really they weren't winning. It was sort of a draw at that point. So these are the various reasons for the Arabs to oppose the ceasefire. But by the second week of June, even the Arabs have to give in and say, fine, we'll put down our weapons for a while. What changed? What made them realize you have to call it quits, at least temporarily? So first of all, their forces were extremely tired. They needed fresh reinforcements, which they could not get under the stalemate. And they needed a resupply of ammunition. They were nearly out of shells. And I don't mean stuffed shells. So Ben-Gurion was told by the IDF leadership that it was in the Jews' best interest to accept the ceasefire. Why? Because our forces need a rest, and we will take advantage of the ceasefire to improve our position on every front. Okay. Well, Bernadotte was regarded by both sides as being impartial. That's important. If you're not seen as impartial, you know, if you're Jared Kushner or Greenblatt, one of these other guys, a Jew from New York and New Jersey, the other side doesn't think you're impartial. It thinks you're in favor of the Jews. So, but Bernadotte, a Goy, a European Goy, was seen as impartial. Okay, so the Arabs eventually agree to this, but they qualify their agreement to the truce by saying this is definitely only temporary, and we will never agree to formal recognition of the existence of a Jewish state. Okay, fine. Later on, after the Arabs lose the war and realize that in the post-ceasefire era they did very poorly, the Arabs would come to regret accepting the truce and to claim that victory was snatched from their hands. Baloney. They weren't winning. But they can say victory was snatched from our hands. Okay. Bernadotte's job was to ensure that neither side violated the arms embargo and that neither side introduced new military personnel into the zone of conflict. This created a major problem for the Jews. Now, who wants to tell me, unmute yourself, why the issue of introducing new military personnel into the zone of conflict is something that the Jews are reluctant to agree to? Anybody have an idea?
Well, because they have more military ready to go.
Well, not exactly. They have people on the ground who are going to be put into uniform, put to the front, but that's an internal matter. I'm talking about an embargo on arms from the outside and troops from the outside coming to fight in the theater. So who do the Jews have waiting in the wings?
Czechoslovakia for arms. What? Czechoslovakia for arms.
Right.
And you have people, immigrants coming.
You have, you have American, Europeans coming in.
Okay, good. So all these are correct answers. The arms are coming from Czechoslovakia, but that Israel is going to do secretly. You know, they're going to break the embargo, but not tell anybody about it and hope they get away with it. And they will get away with it. However, the issue of people is quite another. And Zionism believes in unfettered Jewish immigration to Eretz Yisrael. If there's anything that is basic to Zionism, it is unfettered Jewish immigration to Eretz Yisrael. And so, what do the Jews want? The Jews want the Jewish people who are stuck in Europe, and for that matter, in detention camps on Cyprus, who have already tried to get to Israel, to be allowed in. But some of those people are men of military age. So if an old grandma or a five-year-old wants to leave Cyprus and go to Port Haifa and to settle in Israel during the course of the war, maybe the British are not so upset about that, although they won't open Cyprus for a while anyway. But if it's a boy who's 19 and can fire a weapon, so now this is a soldier, potentially, who is going into the zone. Bernadotte doesn't want that to happen. So the Jews are going to have to reluctantly agree to Bernadotte's terms that military age personnel are not going to be allowed into the country. Of course, the Jews will violate that. American Jews, Canadian Jews, South African Jews, Australian Jews will enter the country with military skills and serve in the IDF, the IAF, and the like. However, on the specific issue of British authorities letting people out of Cyprus, or for that matter, DP camps in Europe, that they had to capitulate and say, fine, those people will be stuck at least for the next 4 weeks. Okay. So Bernadotte set a timeline. Well, there was a shouting match between Moshe Sharet and Bernadotte over this very issue, but the Jews had to give in. Bernadotte set a June 9th deadline for accepting of the ceasefire, for mutual acceptance, and he got mutual acceptance, and the truce went into effect on June 11th, one day after the Burma Road was totally functional. It was supposed to last for 28 days through July 8th. The UN did not have an apparatus, or for that matter, the manpower to enforce this truce. And so therefore, both sides regularly violated it by bringing in fresh military units and more weaponry, including arms from Czechoslovakia and other sources. The situation in Jerusalem was precarious. Yes, the Burma Road was supplying Jerusalem's population with civilian supplies, with civilian aid. However, David Ben-Gurion was petrified. He was very afraid that the Jewish population of the city was going to flee the city and move to Israel. Remember, Jerusalem is not part of Israel. Jerusalem is just Jerusalem. And it's not entirely cut off, but it's hanging on by a thread, and it's dangerous. And the Arab Legion is nearby, and the Egyptians were not far away. So will people pack up and leave Jerusalem in fear for their lives? Just like the Palestinian population of various parts of the country and parts of Jerusalem, including Western Jerusalem, picked up and left, will the Jews of Jerusalem do the same? And so it was incumbent upon Ben-Gurion to get first the Haganah and the IDF to be involved in propaganda in preventing people from fleeing the city. Okay. Now, British intelligence... we have a question from Asher. Was America content to be on the sidelines and let Israel die in the crib in 48? Don't think so. However, the State Department was still popular by anti-Zionists. The answer to that is, Asher, that America was not about to intervene militarily under any circumstance. However, if the war was going badly, which it wasn't, but if it was going really, really badly, the assumption made by the British, and for that matter by the Arabs, was that the Americans would cancel their embargo on armaments to Israel and send significant heavy weapons. Not that the Americans would fight and die, but rather they would relax their restrictions on cooperation between the IDF and Israel and arms suppliers in America. So that would have been the extent of cooperation had it come to it, but it didn't come to it. And yes, the State Department was still heavily anti-Zionist, with rare exception, who was pro-Jewish. But the White House had its pro-Jewish elements. Okay. So what was I up to? Okay. So the British intelligence believed that the Jews would make the best of the truce to improve their military reorganization, whereas the Arabs would squander the benefits of the truce and spend the downtime quibbling over who's going to get the spoils of war. The Kachaya, and that's exactly what happened. The IDF doubled in size between May 15th and July 9th, and Nasser remembered Egyptian soldiers joking around during the truce and not taking their job seriously. The Arab army, the Jewish army that the Arabs faced on July 9th was very different from the Jewish army that the Arabs faced on May 15th. In a span of less than 2 months, the IDF really bolstered itself and was a new fighting force, much more powerful than it was just a few weeks earlier. One other thing that happened during the ceasefire was that new settlements were built in Israel. But Ben-Gurion wanted people to be quiet about that. Don't talk about it. But we're going to build that even during the war, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is important. Okay. Bernadotte wanted peace by Christmas. Peace by Christmas. It's a classic wartime slogan, peace by Christmas. Too bad that the two sides, neither of them observe Christmas, but all right. So he wanted peace by Christmas. And he believed that talk of peace might generate interest in extending the ceasefire, the truce. And instead of being 4 weeks, it might be 8 weeks or 12 weeks. If you keep the peace talks going, nobody's going to want to restart the fighting. However, what were the obstacles to peace, or for that matter, even to extending the truce? There were three major obstacles. One, Arab rejectionism. Two, Israeli expansionism. And three, who wants to guess the third? The big one, the Palestinian refugee crisis. Each one of these three things alone would have been enough to scuttle any real talk of peace. Arab rejectionism maintained itself all the way up until Anwar Sadat in 1977. Israeli expansionism, ad hayom hazeh, expansion, annexation, annexation. Israel wants more and more and more. And the Palestinian refugee crisis. They want right of return and the Jews don't want it. So what's the solution? There's no solution. It was as true in the summer of 48 as it is today. Okay. Now, Bernadotte wanted to achieve some kind of a peace agreement. And he made three assumptions, some of which were correct and some not so correct. The first one, the first assumption of his, Israel is an undeniable reality, albeit a small state with its back to the sea. But it exists, and it's not going to easily be dislodged. Number two, the Jordanian takeover of the West Bank is irreversible. In other words, there isn't going to be a Palestinian state. The Kachaya, Arayom Hazeh, there's no Palestinian state. And point number three, the partition borders of the resolution of 181 in the UN is dead. The old partition borders don't matter anymore. There will be new borders. However, Bernadotte was wrong about a very important point. He believed there was a military balance of power and that it was basically a stalemate. And because there's a stalemate, why would you want to keep on fighting? That both sides have an interest in making some sort of peaceful accommodation. In fact, Israel had the upper hand. Israel was winning the war. What did he propose on the basis of his assumptions and his incorrect theory about the balance of power? So he proposed a union between sovereign Israel and sovereign Jordan. In other words, it's a fig leaf cover over the notion of the Palestinian Arab state. There isn't going to be a Palestinian Arab state. There's going to be Israel and there's Jordan, but some sort of a union, economic union or political union. What about territory? Because after all, everybody cares about territory. The Arabs will get the bulk of the Negev. The Jews will get the Western Galilee. The Arabs will get Jerusalem, except the Jews will get municipal autonomy in those parts of Jerusalem where the Jews live. Lod and Haifa will become free ports, Haifa being the seaport, Lod being Ben-Gurion Airport, the airport. Right? And there's a right of return for Palestinian refugees. Both sides were presented with this plan on June 27th. The proposal was consistent with British interests, and some say that they forced Bernadotte's hand into crafting this proposal. How was it consistent with British interests? Because the British had always wanted a connection between the Eastern Arab world and the Western Arab world. What is the break, the territorial break between Eastern and Western Arab world? Israel. Israel means that Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, all the Emirate countries are not territorially contiguous with Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, Algeria, Sudan, Morocco. That the Arab Muslim world is divided into the African world and the Asian world with no connection because Israel is in between. If the Negev went Arab, then you would have that land bridge between the various parts of the Arab world. Okay. Also, the British had interests in Egypt and in Jordan, and for that matter, Iraq. So they want to have a passageway for themselves to their own military might. Also, by making the Arab parts of Palestine into sections of Jordan, it would give Jordan an outlet to the Mediterranean Sea at Ashdod and Ashkelon, something that they never have but always wanted. Okay, so the main advantage of this proposal was that it reflected contemporary military reality. The reality is, in late June 1948, that the Jews don't control the Negev. Even though the partition plan gave the Jews the Negev, the Jews don't have it, the Arabs do. And even though the partition plan gave the Western Galilee to the Arabs, who has it? The Jews have it. So Bernadotte's plan, while from a Jewish point of view was not good at all, it was not absurd. It did reflect the living reality. Now, the Jews rejected the plan a week after it was submitted. And they were offended by one very important point. They said, how could you give Jerusalem to the Arabs? After all, Jerusalem is a majority Jewish city. On the premise that Jerusalem is not going to be divided into an east and a west, which ultimately it is, but on the premise that it's going to be a united city, it's a majority Jewish. And yes, it's surrounded by a sea of Arabs, but at least make it an international enclave. Don't make Jerusalem a Jewish city into part of the Arab state. That's unfair. It's ridiculous. Okay. But Israel did accept Bernadotte's proposal for a one-month extension of the ceasefire. The Arabs rejected the plan and the extension of the truce. Jordan was the only Arab country ready to extend the truce. Why? Because it had already achieved its territorial goals. It already had as much as it was going to get, so it had no interest in fighting. However, as is often the case in the Arab world, the Jordanians are afraid of being seen as cowardly, as losers, as wimps, and they don't want to be the only vote against continuing the war. So they're pressured by their colleagues, they're bullied, the peer pressure, into saying, fine, we'll keep fighting. No truce, we go to war again starting July 9th. Okay. From an Arab point of view, it was a matter of national pride for the war to continue. And these regimes might not survive if the war didn't continue. And popular resentment might overthrow them. Okay? Even though some of the Arab leaders, in a more cerebral moment, recognized that if they went to war again, they would lose even more badly than they did up to that point. Okay. What happened on the Jewish side of the aisle during the ceasefire? So on June 1st, 2nd, the Irgun, who controlled Beersheba? Beersheba was controlled by the Arabs. Beersheba would not be taken until later in the war. Israel's Air Force was born in 48 and helped to win the war for Israel with all volunteers. Okay, correct. So the Israel Air Force was very important in the later phases of the war, especially against the Egyptians in November, December, and January, and the vast bulk of the pilots were volunteers who had served in the Allied armies in World War II. Okay, and the issue of Beersheba we're going to get to in the coming weeks, the later stages of the war against the Egyptians, how the Negev is conquered, including Beersheba. Okay, but the Irgun signs a deal with the IDF, represented by Galili, that its fighters would join the IDF, but in special Irgun units of the IDF, and that the Irgun in Jerusalem would remain a separate organization because Jerusalem is not part of the state of Israel just yet. So there's a separate Irgun Jerusalem, and then there are Irgun units in the IDF in Israel proper. The Altalena affair busted all that open. We don't have time tonight to discuss the Altalena affair at any length, but for those of you who were with me in previous years, in the first lecture of last year's cycle, 2018-19, we discussed the Altalena and the politics behind it. And 3 years ago, we discussed the biography of Menachem Begin and the story behind the Altalena. But for our purposes now, what is the relevance of the Altalena affair on June 19th to 21st? Well, it meant the demise of the Irgun in Israel proper and the incorporation of Irgun fighters, not into separate Irgun units in the IDF, but rather just as individuals, as yechidim, to be conscripted into the various units. So there's no more Irgun in Israel proper. There's only an Irgun and a Lehi in Yerushalayim, and those organizations will cease to exist after the assassination of Folk Bernadotte, which we'll have to talk about maybe in about 2 weeks. So next week, we're going to discuss what happens when the war resumes in July of 1948. Where is the action? Who's winning? And more generally, what is the trajectory of the war when it comes to Israel's intentions? What is Israel trying to accomplish? Because once they have the initiative, and it's no longer the Arabs dictating where the battles will be, Israel has to make serious decisions. What territory is it worth fighting for? If we're not going to conquer the whole of the country, and they're not going to, you have to make choices. What's more important? So next time we'll discuss July of 48. Any questions? We have 2 minutes. Any questions? Yes? No?
Yes, Rabbi.
I wonder how this jives with the upcoming, perhaps, annexation. You know, where would the founders be on a situation like this?
I can't really answer that, but suffice it to say that Ben-Gurion wanted control of as much of Eretz Israel as possible, and he would be hard-pressed not to grab things. Yes, Les.
Are you planning to go through the whole of summer with your lectures, or you?
The intention, I believe, is to do another 3 or 4 weeks, and then we'll stop. Probably in August, we won't have class. I don't know for sure. And in September, we'll start a new topic. We have a new season in September, so we're at least going to have another 4 weeks, maybe even more.
Okay.
Have a good week, everybody. Okay. Shavua tov.